This installment of the award-winning, critically acclaimed Radio Tales series is brought to you by Generations Radio Theater. More information about this series is available at our official website at www.radiotales.com. This is a Generations production. The ocean sometimes calls the bold of heart to embark upon fantastic adventures. Voyages that forever change their point of view. But for a journeyman doctor, that change is about to become quite literal. As he looks upon an exotic world from an extraordinary new perspective. Gulliver's Travels. On this installment of Tales by the Masters. Gulliver's Travels by Jonathan Swift. Adapted for this series by Winnie Waldron. Part 1. Performed by Winifred Phillips.
Gulliver had always believed that it would be his fortune to travel. After 3 years of expectation, he accepted an advantageous offer from Captain William Pritchard, master of the Antelope, who was making a voyage to the South Sea. The Antelope set sail on May 4th, and its voyage at first was very prosperous. But in its adventures, the boat was overset by a sudden flurry from the north. What became of Gulliver's companions in the boat, Gulliver never knew. But he concluded that they were all lost. For his own part, Gulliver swam as fortune directed him, and was pushed forward by wind and tide. He often let his legs drop, and could feel no bottom. But when he was almost gone, and able to struggle no longer, he found himself within his depth. And by this time the storm was much abated. The declivity was so small that he walked near a mile before he got to the shore, which he conjectured was about 8 o'clock in the evening. He then advanced forward near half a mile, but could not discover any signs of houses or inhabitants. At least, he was in so weak a condition that he did not observe them. He was extremely tired. And with that, and the heat of the weather, and about half a pint of brandy that he drank as he left the ship, he found himself much inclined to sleep. He lay down on the grass, which was very short and soft, where he slept sounder than ever he remembered to have done in his life. And as he reckoned, above 9 hours, for when he awakened, it was just daylight. He attempted to rise, but was not able to stir. For as he happened to lie on his back, he found his arms and legs were strongly fastened on each side to the ground. And his hair, which was long and thick, tied down in the same manner. He likewise felt several slender ligatures across his body, from his armpits to his thighs. He could only look upwards. The sun began to grow hot, and the light offended his eyes. He heard a confused noise about him, but in the pasture he lay, could see nothing except the sky. In a little time he felt something alive, moving on his left leg, which, advancing gently forward over his breast, came up almost to his chin. When bending his eyes downwards as much as he could, he perceived it to be a human creature not 6 inches high, with a bow and arrow in his hands, and a quiver at his back. In the meantime, Gulliver felt at least 40 more of the same kind, as he conjectured, following the first. He was in the utmost astonishment and roared so loud that they all ran back in a fright. And some of them, as he was afterwards told, were hurt with the falls they got by leaping from Gulliver's sides upon the ground. However, they soon returned, and one of them, who ventured so far as to get a full sight of Gulliver's face, lifting up his hands and eyes by way of admiration, cried out in a shrill but distinct voice, "The others repeated the same words several times, but Gulliver then knew not what they meant. He lay all this while in great uneasiness. At length, struggling to get loose, he had the fortune to break the strings and wrench out the pegs that fastened his left arm to the ground. For by lifting it up to his face, he discovered the methods they had taken to bind him. And at the same time, with a violent pull, which gave him excessive pain, he a little loosened the strings that tied down his hair on the left side, so that he was just able to turn his head about 2 inches. But the creatures ran off a second time before Gulliver could seize them. Whereupon there was a great shout in a very shrill accent. And after it ceased, he heard one of them cry aloud,
"Tolgofonac!"
When in an instant Gulliver felt above 100 arrows discharged on his left hand, which pricked him like so many needles. And besides, they shot another flight into the air as bombs are launched, whereof many fell on his body, though he felt them not, and some on his face, which he immediately covered with his left hand. When this shower of arrows was over, he fell a-groaning with grief and pain, and then striving again to get loose, they discharged another volley larger than the first, and some of them attempted with spears to stick Gulliver in the sides. But by good luck, he had on him a buff jerkin, which they could not pierce. He thought it the most prudent method to lie still, and his design was to continue so till night, when, his left hand being already loose, he could easily free himself. And as for the inhabitants, he had reason to believe he might be a match for the greatest armies they could bring against him, if they were all of the same size with him that Gulliver saw. But fortune disposed otherwise of Gulliver. When the people observed Gulliver was quiet, they discharged no more arrows, but by the noise he heard, he knew their numbers increased. And about 4 yards from him, over against his right ear, he heard a knocking for above an hour, like that of people at work. When turning his head that way, as well as the pegs and strings would permit him, Gulliver saw a stage erected, about a foot and a half from the ground, capable of holding four of the inhabitants, with two or three ladders to mount it from whence one of them, who seemed to be a person of quality, made Gulliver a long speech, whereof he understood not one syllable. But before the principal person began this oration, he cried out three times,
"Langro de Hulsan!"
These words and the former were afterwards repeated and explained to Gulliver. Whereupon immediately about 50 of the inhabitants came and cut the strings that fastened the left side of his head, which gave Gulliver the liberty of turning it to the right, and of observing the person and gesture of him that was to speak. The little figure appeared to be of a middle age, and taller than any of the other three who attended him, whereof one was a page that held up his train, and seemed to be somewhat longer than Gulliver's middle finger. The other two stood, one on each side, to support him. He acted every part of an orator, and Gulliver could observe many periods of threatenings, and others of promises, pity, and kindness. Gulliver answered in a few words, but in the most submissive manner, lifting up his left hand, and both his eyes to the sun, as calling him for a witness. And being almost famished with hunger, having not eaten a morsel for some hours before he left the ship, he found the demands of nature so strong upon him that he could not forbear showing his impatience, perhaps against the strict rules of decency, by putting his finger frequently on his mouth to signify that he wanted food. The Hurgo, for so they call a great lord, as Gulliver afterwards learned, understood Gulliver very well. The lord descended from the stage and commanded that several ladders should be applied to Gulliver's sides, on which above 100 of the inhabitants mounted and walked towards Gulliver's mouth, laden with baskets full of meat, which had been provided and sent thither by the king's orders upon the first intelligence the king received of Gulliver. Gulliver observed there was the flesh of several animals, but could not distinguish them by the taste. There were shoulders, legs, and joints, shaped like those of mutton, and very well dressed, but smaller than the wings of a lark. Gulliver ate them by two or three at a mouthful, and took three loaves at a time, about the bigness of musket bullets. They supplied him as they could, showing 1,000 marks of wonder and astonishment at his bulk and appetite. He then made another sign that he wanted drink. They found by his eating that a small quantity would not suffice him, and being a most ingenious people, they slung up with great dexterity one of their largest hogsheads, then rolled it towards his hand and beat out the top. Gulliver drank it off at a draught, which he might well do, for it did not hold half a pint, and tasted like a small wine of Burgundy, but much more delicious. They brought him a second hogshead, which he drank in the same manner, and made signs for more, but they had none to give. When he had performed these wonders, they shouted for joy and danced upon his breast, repeating several times as they did at first,
"Hakina Tikul!"
They made Gulliver a sign that he should throw down the two hogsheads, but first warning the people below to stand out of the way, crying aloud, and when they saw the vessels in the air, there was a universal shout of Oliver was often tempted, while they were passing backwards and forwards on his body, to seize 40 or 50 of the first that came into his reach and dash them against the ground. But the remembrance of what he had felt, which probably might not be the worst they could do, and the promise of honor he made them, for so he interpreted his submissive behavior, soon drove out these imaginations. Besides, Gulliver now considered himself as bound by the laws of hospitality to a people who had treated him with so much expense and magnificence. However, in his thoughts, he could not sufficiently wonder at the intrepidity of those diminutive mortals who durst venture to mount and walk upon his body, while one of his hands was at liberty, without trembling at the very sight of so prodigious a creature as he must appear to them. After some time, when they observed that Gulliver made no more demands for meat, there appeared before him a person of high rank from His Imperial Majesty, His Excellency having mounted on the small of Gulliver's right leg, advanced forwards up to Gulliver's face, with about a dozen of his retinue, and producing his credentials under the signet royal, which he applied close to Gulliver's eyes, spoke 10 minutes, without any signs of anger, but with a kind of determinate resolution, often pointing forwards, which, as Gulliver afterwards found, was toward the capital city, about half a mile distant, whither it was agreed by His Majesty in council that Gulliver must be conveyed. Gulliver answered in a few words, but to no purpose, and made a sign with his hand that was loose, putting it to the other, but over His Excellency's head, for fear of hurting him or his train, and then to Gulliver's own head and body to signify that he desired his liberty. It appeared that His Excellency understood Gulliver well enough, for he shook his head by way of disapprobation, and held his hand in a posture to show that Gulliver must be carried as a prisoner. However, he made other signs to let Gulliver understand that he should have meat and drink enough, and very good treatment. Whereupon Gulliver once more thought of attempting to break his bonds. But again, when he felt the smart of their arrows upon his face and hands, which were all in blisters, and many of the darts still sticking in them, and observing likewise that the number of his enemies increased, he gave tokens to let them know that they might do with him as they pleased. Upon this, the Hurgo and his train withdrew with much civility and cheerful countenances. Soon after, Gulliver heard a general shout, with frequent repetitions of the words
Peplom Salon,
and he felt great numbers of the people on his left side relaxing the cords to such a degree that he was able to turn upon his right, and to ease himself, making water, which he very plentifully did, to the great astonishment of the people, who, conjecturing to his motions what he was going to do, immediately opened to the right and left on that side to avoid the torrent which fell with such noise and violence from him. But before this, they had daubed Gulliver's face and both his hands with a sort of ointment very pleasant to the smell, which in a few minutes removed all the smart of their arrows. These circumstances, added to the refreshment he had received by their victuals and drink, which were very nourishing, disposed him to sleep. Gulliver slept about 8 hours, as he was afterwards assured, And it was no wonder, for the physicians, by the Emperor's order, had mingled a sleepy potion in the hogsheads of wine. It seems that upon the first moment he was discovered sleeping on the ground after his landing, the Emperor had early notice of it by an express, and determined in council that Gulliver should be tied, in the manner here related, which was done in the night, while he slept, that plenty of meat and drink should be sent him, and a machine prepared to carry him to the capital city. This resolution perhaps may appear very bold and dangerous, and would most likely not be imitated by any prince in Europe on the like occasion. However, it was extremely prudent, as well as generous. For supposing these people had endeavored to kill Gulliver with their spars and arrows while he was asleep, he should certainly have awaked with the first sense of smart, which might so far have roused his rage and strength as to have enabled him to break the strings wherewith he was tied. After which, as they were not able to make resistance, so they could expect no mercy. These people were most excellent mathematicians, and arrived to a great perfection in mechanics by the countenance and encouragement of the Emperor, who is a renowned patron of learning. This prince hath several machines fixed on wheels for the carriage of trees and other great weights. He often builds his largest men of war, whereof some are 9 foot long, in the woods where the timber grows, and has them carried on these engines 300 or 400 yards to the sea. 500 carpenters and engineers were immediately set to work to prepare the greatest engine they had. It was a frame of wood, raised 3 inches from the ground, about 7 foot long and 4 foot wide, moving on 22 wheels. The shout Gulliver heard was upon the arrival of this engine, which it seems set out in 4 hours after his landing. It was brought parallel to Gulliver as he lay, but the principal difficulty was to raise and place Gulliver on this vehicle. 80 poles, each of 1 foot high, were erected for this purpose, and very strong cords of the bigness of pack thread were fastened by hooks to many bandages, which the workmen had girt round Gulliver's neck, his hands, his body, and his legs. 900 of the strongest men were employed to draw up these cords by many pulleys fastened on the poles. And thus, in less than 3 hours, Gulliver was raised and slung into the engine and there tied fast. All this he was told, for while the whole operation was performing, he lay in a profound sleep. By the force of that medicine infused into his liquor, 1,500 of the Emperor's largest horses, each about 4.5 inches high, were employed to draw Gulliver toward the metropolis, which, as we have said, was 0.5 mile distant. After they began their journey, Gulliver awaked by a very ridiculous accident. For the carriage being stopped a while to adjust something that was out of order, 2 or 3 of the young natives had the curiosity to see how Gulliver looked when he was asleep. They climbed up into the engine and, advancing very softly to his face, One of them, an officer in the guards, put the sharp end of his half-pike a good way up into Gulliver's left nostril, which tickled his nose like a straw and made him sneeze violently, whereupon they stole off unperceived. And it was 3 weeks before Gulliver knew the cause of his awakening so suddenly. The company and their massive vehicle made a long march the remaining part of that day, and rested at night with 500 guards on each side of Gulliver, half with torches and half with bows and arrows, ready to shoot him if he should offer to stir. The next morning at sunrise, they continued their march and arrived within 200 yards of the city gates about noon. The emperor and all his court came out to meet them, but his great officers would by no means suffer his majesty to endanger his person by mounting on Gulliver's body. At the place where the carriage stopped, there stood an ancient temple, esteemed to be the largest in the whole kingdom, which, having been polluted some years before by an unnatural murder, was, according to the zeal of those people, looked on as profane, and therefore had been applied to common uses and all the ornaments and furniture carried away. In this edifice it was determined Gulliver should lodge. The great gate fronting to the north was about 4 foot high and almost 2 foot wide, through which Gulliver could easily creep. On each side of the gate was a small window, not above 6 inches from the ground. Into that on the left side, the king's smiths conveyed 411 chains, like those that hang to a lady's watch, and almost as large, which were locked to Gulliver's left leg with 36 padlocks.
Part 1 of Gulliver's Travels. Gulliver's Travels was written by Jonathan Swift and adapted for this series by Winnie Waldron. The musical score was written and performed by Winifred Phillips. Titles and credit narration were performed by Winnie Waldron, the director of this program. The Tale series is produced by Generations Radio Theater, which is solely responsible for its content. Phonograph and music underscore copyright, W.P. Phillips. All rights reserved.